Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good Monday morning. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up this hour, state lawmakers begin another week at the Capitol with continued uncertainty over state income taxes. And will new economic impact numbers from state universities get the schools more money from the legislature?
But we begin with the latest in the future of Hacienda Healthcare. The long-term care facility announced late last week that it would be closing the doors of its intermediate care facility in Phoenix, months after news broke that a woman with severe disabilities there was raped and gave birth to a baby boy. The announcement of this closure angered disability advocates and lawmakers alike. Governor Doug Ducey said it was another failure for these patients.
We've put a 24-hour monitor inside Hacienda to make sure that the patients are cared for and they are comfortable. And now we're working on the long-term solution for these people so that their lives aren't disrupted.
Then on Friday night, Hacienda issued a statement saying the facility will in fact stay open and that it agreed to accept voluntary regulation by the Arizona Department of Health Services. For more on this, we're joined now by Dr. Kara Crist, director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Good morning, Dr. Crist.
Good morning.
So begin by telling us why it was important to you to step in here.
So these patients that are at the intermediate care facility have very high acuity medical needs. They can be on ventilators round the clock. They need round the clock respiratory care. Given these high medical risks, transferring these patients puts them at a significant risk for physical and emotional harm. This medically fragile community, moving them is the option of last resort. And so we really wanted to do everything we could do to ensure their health and safety. That's our primary goal.
There's also a question of where to move them, right? Like there aren't that many options.
There aren't that many what are termed ICF IIDs. That's the intermediate care facility in Arizona. So, yes, capacity is an issue as well as just the physical act of transferring them. Some of these people, this has been their home for decades.
Mm-hmm. So the state is stepping in essentially to regulate this and taking over the licensing here. Tell us a little bit about what that looks like. What are you asking of Hacienda?
So what we're going to ask them to do is voluntarily enter into a regulatory agreement with the Department of Health Services. Because they've been exempt from licensing by the department for the last 22 years, this will enter into a contract with the department that will give us increased oversight and accountability of the facility. They will have to operate within state law. They will have us regulating them and ensuring the health and safety of that. We will be asking them to get a healthcare consultant to oversee the operations. We will ask them to put on-site monitors. We will ask them to develop their 90-day plan for what they're, because they keep changing their mind, what are they determined to do? And so we will be working with them as early as this morning to start entering into this agreement.
Okay. I want to ask a little bit about the resources this will take. You're saying that this is what you're asking of Hacienda. Is this going to be a big job for your department, though, to take over?
So we regulate a lot of different facilities. We have provider agreements with many facilities that either need to come into compliance or we are working with to bring into compliance so that they're following state law. And so it may take at the beginning a little bit of resources, but we are going to be working very closely with them.
Okay, so then I guess what are your hopes here? What would you like to see come out of this in as far as your own role and the future of this facility?
What we would like to see, obviously, our primary goal is the health and safety of these very fragile patients. So we would like to see them stay open, have this facility come into compliance, follow all rules, be in compliance with their contracts, with the DD program, and then just to make sure that they are running an appropriate business in Arizona.
So if you are taking over regulation here and outlining all of these things you'd like them to agree to, does that include any repercussions? Like if they do not do the things that you are requiring of them under this licensing agreement, will you be able to take any action?
So there is a bill right now that is going through the legislature that if policymakers decide, will take away that exemption. So what we're hoping that this agreement serves is just a bridge to until we can get that regulation in place. And then, yes, through the contract that we'll be setting up, as well as hopefully when if that legislation passes, we'll have a lot of teeth. We also regulate a lot of their other facilities, and so it's always a good idea to stay in a good relationship with your regulator.
All right. That is Dr. Kara Crist, director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Crist.
Thank you.
Taxes and elections continue to be big topics of discussion and debate at the state capitol, but lawmakers are also reacting to new developments in the case of Hacienda Healthcare. With me for our weekly look ahead at the goings-on in the Arizona legislature is Katie Campbell of the Arizona Capital Times. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
So we just heard Kara Crist, the Health Services Department Director, talking about what lawmakers at the Capitol might be looking at doing as it relates to not just Hacienda Healthcare, but these types of facilities. Where do we stand on those kinds of efforts at the moment?
Yes, so she was referring to a bill from Senator Heather Carter, Senate Bill 1211, which would take care of that licensure issue. Now, it was scheduled to be heard last week in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, but for some reason it was stricken at the last moment from that agenda. They did not discuss it. I imagine that had to do with some kind of technical issue, because this is a very popular idea. Representative Jennifer Longden over in the House, a Democrat in the House, has described it as the no-brainer place to start in addressing the issue of sexual abuse and abuse in general in the disability community. Now, that bill is back on the Senate Health and Human Services Committee agenda for this Wednesday, so I'll be watching to see if it goes through. I imagine it will. There is also another bill from Senator Alston, 1384, which asks for a $3 million appropriation for Adult Protective Services to expand their staff, which are responsible for investigating reports of abuse and exploitation of vulnerable adults. Now, whether that's actually going to get a hearing in the Senate Appropriations Committee is yet to be seen, but it is an idea that the governor's office has told me they are open to, and the Planning Council, the Developmental Disabilities Planning Council, rather, has specifically asked for more money and more staffers for Adult Protective Services.
Okay, you mentioned the first bill that's back on the Senate committee agenda for this week. You mentioned that it seems like a fairly popular idea. Does it appear as though this is something that a majority, the requisite number of lawmakers, are behind to get this done?
I would certainly be surprised if there wasn't that requisite number of lawmakers to support it. It seems like the obvious place to start. There was this carve-out made for intermediate care facilities back in the 90s, and when I ask lawmakers about that carve-out today, that licensing carve-out, no one can really explain to me why anybody thought that was a good idea at the time. So now everyone's looking at it. They're looking at the situation with Hacienda and wondering, you know, if the state was able to get into that facility and see that there was a problem sooner, could something more have been done? So this is really an easy way of preventing that. Really, this is this law that blocks the state from getting involved in a lot of ways, just to do away with it, to eliminate it and make sure that they have that access.
All right, so let's talk taxes for a minute. And the state still, taxpayers don't really know what's happening as far as tax conformity. And now there's this idea of maybe pushing back the filing deadline. What is going on with all this?
That's a great question.
I bet some lawmakers would like to know too, right?
Exactly. And I wish I could predict where all of this is going and tell you whether it's safe or not to file your taxes just yet, but I'm just not sure. Senator J.D. Mesnard has asked for, or he's filed a proposal for an extended deadline for Arizonans to file their state tax returns. Now, that wouldn't impact the federal deadline, but it might give Arizonans some wiggle room while the Republican legislators and the governor really hash out this difference that they've met in terms of tax conformity. The governor, of course, just wants to simply conform, and basically the state would get a windfall in tax funds, and the Republican legislators want to conform and reform to the state tax code to make sure that money goes back to Arizonans. So I'm not really sure where this goes at this point. I think the longer this conversation goes on, the more Democrats really become empowered to participate more in the budget process, but that also means the governor has to reach out to them as well and give them that opportunity, and I don't know if he's yet willing to do that.
Well, Katie, does it seem realistic that the Senator Mesnard's bill to push back the filing deadline could go forward? I mean, does it seem like the governor, for one, would be on board with that?
Well, that's the biggest question, isn't it? Is what happens if this proposal now goes to the governor? I don't know that he's going to be, jumping at the opportunity to sign this one either. So I honestly don't know what to expect from this conversation. I really think it's going to come down to who's willing to sit down and make concessions on this topic. But for the time being, Arizonans just kind of have to wait and see what happens and when is best to file their taxes, I guess.
Boy, CPAs must be absolutely loving this.
Oh, I'm sure.
Unbelievable. That's Katie Campbell. She covers the Arizona House of Representatives for the Arizona Capital Times. Katie, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Arizona's three public universities, ASU, the U of A, and NAU, currently have nearly 105,000 undergraduate students, and more than 36,000 people work at the schools, either full or part-time. And even with state funding being cut dramatically, primarily during the Great Recession, the footprint of the universities via students, research, and other factors is unquestionably large. But for the first time, the Arizona Board of Regents commissioned a report to specifically flesh out the economic impact of the universities. I spoke with A-Board Chair Ron Schupman about it and asked him why such a report was important at this stage.
I think it is very important that we have an ability to at least quantify what the value of our university operations are for comparative purposes. Everyone knows that we exist in three places in the state, but I don't think many of them recognize that it reaches an $11.1 billion of economic impact, roughly the same as all of the military bases in the state.
One thing that for me stood out because of the purposes of at least many universities is the impact related to university research.
University research, of course, is an incredible component of growing Arizona's innovation economy for the future. It also has direct impact on the quality of life of the people who live in our state, the medical advances, so many things that come out of our universities that transfer into either new companies or discoveries that improve the life of the people of our state and beyond, is such a critical factor to having these two large research universities and another one that's doing a significant amount of research for a university of its size.
What did you learn that might, in fact, help give you more insights going forward and might make the university system even stronger?
I think what we were hoping to do is validate what we already believed. And I think this report did show us how various segments of the operations of our three universities contribute in unique ways. The impact of the students alone, I think the non-resident students and out-of-state visitors that support more than 2,000 jobs, resulting in $181 million. While that's a small piece of this, it does speak to the breadth of the impact that our universities have on the state.
And does it appear to be on an upward trajectory right now?
Unlike universities across the nation where there has been some pullback on enrollment, our universities continue to grow and to thrive, and it's necessary that they do because we believe Arizona is a state that is ready to continue to be an economic juggernaut, and to do that will require that we become more and more technologically advanced. As those advances happen across the nation and around the world, we have to have the workforce, the infrastructure, and the leadership prepared to take full advantage of what might be possible in Arizona, not just in the next 5 years, but in the next 50 years.
We, of course, know the story about during the Great Recession, how state funding was dramatically changed and the university system has changed and tried to be nimble to deal with that, certainly. But is there a situation where, frankly, as big an impact as the universities are having, it could be even better if there were state funding or a different sort of funding as well?
The funding that we have from the state is far below the agreed-to level of funding that we reached a few years ago, what the now known as the 50-50 model, where the state would pay for 50% of the cost to educate Arizona students. The universities will find that other 50% in order to do that. We're down at about 34%. And what that limits is our ability to get more of our young people and more of our citizens into our three universities. We have significant underattainment in four-year degrees in Arizona compared to the nation. We're about 20% behind our the national average. And what that means is that we won't have the workforce or all the other benefits of education beyond high school to enjoy.
And we know that, of course, with the legislative session going on, there are budget talks going on. The governor has issued his proposal. There's also talk about increasing the sales tax related to education, which had been focused on K-12. There's also some mention of some of that money, if the tax were to go into effect, to go toward university funding. Without this hitting lawmakers over the head, is an impact study like this important to let them know, listen, we're doing great things, but if you did get us to that 50-50 situation, think about how much more we could do. Is that a message that is being sent with this? It's just being sent in a way that has data behind it.
It absolutely is a message that's essential that we get to the people of Arizona, as well as our leaders in the legislature and the governor. We have an absolute need to increase the education of the people of Arizona for the future of the state. We need to make sure that the young people of today will have that opportunity. More funding opens that door. And I think it's imperative that we see some of these initiatives come to fruition, and we applaud the legislators who are calling for increased funding for the entire pipeline. It's more than higher ed, but it must include higher ed.
Ron Schubman is the chair of the Arizona Board of Regents. Thanks very much for the time today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Arizona has a teacher shortage and has had one for at least a few years now. Earlier this year, the Arizona School Personnel Administrators Association survey found within the districts that replied, more than 20% of teacher vacancies statewide were still open, and that more than 900 teachers had left their jobs in the first half of the school year. In an effort to try to stem that tide, State Representative Randy Fries is proposing an experienced teacher retention pilot program. The Tucson Democrat wants to offer certified public school teachers who've been in the classroom for at least 3 years the chance to get an advanced degree. His bill would offer a 75% tuition reduction at the state's three public universities. Teachers who took part in the program would then owe the state three more years in public schools. For those teachers who've been in the classroom for a decade, their families would also be eligible for the reduced tuition. I spoke with Fries earlier about his proposal.
The program is designed to keep our teachers here while they're advancing their education. We require them to stay three more years after, get them so close to the tenure mark, if they're in the program, that they might stay till the tenure mark, and then their family can benefit. And if their children go to one of our state schools, they may stay in Arizona. So, I'm hoping it has some long-term effects. And as I said, it's designed as a study, so there will be monies available throughout the program for grants to invite academicians to study teacher flight problems, to fund the studies, and define if this program is having an effect. And if we demonstrate an effect, we hopefully would then continue the program.
When you look at the reasons why teachers don't stay in the classroom, be it here in Arizona or elsewhere, is access to getting a master's or a PhD one of the top issues?
Teacher flight is a problem, and most teachers wish to further their ability to be a great teacher in the classroom and to further their career ladder by getting that education and offering the benefit of, hey, we can help you get this education that will help you in your career, help you make you a better teacher. We can get this to you at a much more affordable rate. I don't know if every teacher would access this avenue, but it's my understanding that most teachers are interested in going back and getting a degree. And it is a benefit. It is something that is hopefully going to entice teachers to stay and draw them into trying to reach that second tier. And I think the important thing I want to mention here is that this program is designed with funding in it from the very beginning. The governor's Teacher Academy was unfunded for several years. I think this year we're finally funding it. Well, my program has funding in it. It's just up to the level that we need to decide the funding to support the program. And that certainly can be more or less depending on how much we want to invest in this program.
So do you see this then as maybe a complement to other issues like increasing teacher pay and reducing class sizes, other things that teachers say that they want and need to stay in the profession?
Well, that's a great point. Now, I developed this program, as I said, back in 2015, I introduced it back in 2016 for the first time, when there wasn't a lot of money in the budget. Now that there's more money in the budget, I believe that we should be prioritizing what we're going to do with our schools and K-12 funding. And one of them, of course, is teacher raises. The other, of course, is classified employee raises. Of course, there's always money for the classroom and getting the district additional assistance funding back up to where it needs to be. So we have to prioritize now that we have some money to invest in K-12, or I should say restore in our K-12 public school system. We need to prioritize where we're going to start. I think getting money back to the classrooms needs to be high on that list. Personally, I believe that a program like this is also something that should be begun. I believe it goes hand in hand with the governor's Teacher Academy. Now that we're funding that, let's look at funding a tool to influence retention. Recruitment, bring new teachers into our schools. Retention, keep the good teachers from leaving by giving them a reward. If we're increasing their salaries, that's excellent. That also helps. If we could reduce classroom size, that helps our teachers be more effective and feel more effective in their job. And then this would be another perk, benefit, reward. Hey, if you stay here in Arizona, we'll help you become a better teacher. We'll help you with your career development. We'll help you move up the career ladder by rewarding you with this opportunity.
Understanding that you're really just calling for a pilot study at this point, but assuming that it works, how big of a dent do you think this could put into the teacher flight, the teacher shortage problem we have here?
Well, I don't know if it's how big of a dent. That what's important is are teachers interested in it? And it may, 5 years may not be long enough to see a significant reduction. If we see a trend, that might be enough for us to say, hey, we should continue this program for another 5 years. Or if we just get feedback and the teachers that are participating say, this is a great program. This helped me with my professional development. This made me a better teacher. That alone might be enough. If we get, the several hundred teachers that initially participate say, this was an excellent program, the sample size might not be large enough to see, statistically a difference. If we get great feedback, we should expand the program. If we see a trend, we should expand the program. Those are the things I'd be looking for to make funding decisions to continue the program.
State Representative Randy Freese is a Democrat from Tucson and the sponsor of House Bill 2525. We'll post a link to the measure at theshow.kjzz.org. The bill would allocate $2.5 million in the first year, eventually ramping up to $10 million by the fifth year of the pilot program. And with me to talk more about whether this kind of program could be effective at dealing with the state's teacher shortage is Rebecca Gao. She's Executive Director of Stanford Children Arizona. And Rebecca, what do you make of this proposal?
Well, I really appreciate leaders trying to do everything they can to support teachers. So it certainly can't hurt in the environment we're in with the teacher market and the exacerbated teacher crisis. So it can't hurt. I really am intrigued by the portion of it in which veterans who have been there over 10 years, it's not just themselves, but also their spouses and dependents. That's intriguing to me, and that's a little new. We have had tuition forgiveness or loan forgiveness programs for teachers. There's actually a bucket existing right now that just doesn't have any money in it. So we've tried these things before, and they haven't necessarily stemmed the outflow of teachers. But I think everything we can do to make teachers feel supported and appreciated is not a bad idea. And the bill also funds the pilot. It's considered a pilot, and so it does fund the research behind it, which I do think is important. We need to understand the types of incentives that actually mean something to teachers beyond straight teacher pay.
When you look at some of the factors that cause teachers to leave, and you reference the fact that Arizona continues to lose teachers in large numbers, does access to an advanced degree seem to be one of those factors? I mean, we hear so much about teacher pay and class sizes, things like that. I mean, where would you rank what this bill is trying to address in terms of access to higher education for teachers and then eventually their families as well, relative to all those other factors that we hear so much about?
Well, I think the key is the phrase you just said, relative to other factors. There's one element related to the teaching profession in which the higher degrees you get, you actually could price yourself out of a teaching job. So we do need to be careful. You're too qualified, and those higher paid positions are often the first to go when there's a budgetary problem, because you're now the curriculum coordinator. Well, you don't get rid of the teacher, you get rid of the person who's helping the teachers. But the larger problem is overall teacher pay, the overall living wage. So it's great to have incentives, and it's great to acknowledge the needs of teachers, but there's a much bigger fish to fry that that we need to be focusing on.
I'm wondering if the approach that this idea is taking in terms of having a pilot program to, you know, put a little bit of money relative to the overall size of the budget into it, see how it works, and if it works, great, keep funding it. If not, let's try something else.
Right. And that's a common way for programs to get started in Arizona. So the appropriations for this are as a 5-year pilot. In the final 2 years, the bill has a $10 million price tag. In the early years, it's less because it's ramping up the pilot and evaluation. That's all super smart. And I do agree that it's relatively $10 million in the end, $10 million a year then, is not a whole ton of money to figure out if this is a viable incentive. We do need all the information we can get about what's motivating teachers. That said, I have seen programs like this kind of come and go, and the data comes out, and if you're not careful, it's really hard to interpret. Or the department or legislators get a report, and then we don't do anything with it, and the thing sunsets, and it just kind of goes away, even if there are people who liked it. So there are a lot of factors going into the success of a pilot like this, but as an initial attempt to examine how teachers are impacted by these types of incentive, I think that could be helpful.
So would you see this then as maybe a complement to other things like increasing teacher pay and making sure that class sizes are reduced somewhat, and some of the other things that we talked about that teachers have said they need? Is this maybe like a, not by itself will help the problem, but combined with other things could make a dent?
I think it could. The other element of it that I'm intrigued by, that wasn't clear from reading the bill, is what subject the teachers would be getting their advanced degrees in. Because if it's subject matter specific, that could be amazing. We do know that, for example, how to teach reading to low-income kids is very different than how you teach reading to kids who come to school with a strong vocabulary. We know that math requires an extensive depth of knowledge in that subject, but yet math teachers don't necessarily get very much of that. So something like that could actually improve the teaching profession if it was helping their skills, but didn't set them on a track to then have to leave the classroom to make ends meet.
All right. Rebecca Gao is Executive Director of Stand for Children. Rebecca, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger with Mark Brody. Thanks for listening this morning. We're joined now by The Takeaway's Arun Roth. Last week, Pope Francis acknowledged for the first time that nuns had been the victims of sexual crimes by religious leaders in the Catholic Church. We now look at an alleged sexual abuse inside another religious institution, one that was founded here in the U.S., the Southern Baptist Convention.
Just this weekend, a new investigation revealed decades of sexual abuse by church leaders and volunteers. Compiled after 6 months of reporting by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, the investigation found that since 1988, some 380 church leaders and volunteers have faced allegations of sexual misconduct. To date, 220 have been convicted. Some took plea deals, others confessed or resigned. But others are still involved in churches where they may have access to potential victims. The perpetrators of these crimes came from all levels of power within the church, from youth pastors and ministers to Sunday school teachers and deacons. There are more than 700 victims. Joining me now are two of the journalists who helped report this investigation. Robert Downen is a reporter with the Houston Chronicle, and Lisa Olson is deputy investigations editor at the Houston Chronicle.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Arun.
Robert, can you start by giving us a sense of scale here? How big is a Southern Baptist church? How many churches are there, and how is it structured?
Sure. So I think that's a really important thing and dynamic to this story is that, unlike the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention is very decentralized. While we do reference, you know, SBC leaders within our story, there is no Pope or someone who can, you know, make decrees and force other churches to do really anything. A bedrock of the Baptist polity is local church autonomy, which means that the 47,000 churches that cooperate as part of the Southern Baptist Convention really are self-governing and independent, which is one of the reasons that implementing reforms to stop the kind of sexual abuses that we found has been a difficult thing, speaking among the broader Southern Baptist Convention.
And it's a wide range of churches across the country, you know, the mega churches to small town churches.
Sure. And I think also there's a tendency to think, because of the name Southern Baptist Convention, that all of these churches are located in the South. That is incorrect. We found, you know, cases in New York, cases in Oregon. While the name implies that they are based in the South, they are very much a nationwide and really worldwide organization.
Now, your investigation found a pattern of sexual assault and abuse. How far does this go, both in time and geography?
So we wanted to focus on, you know, the 20-year period since 1998, because 2008 was the year that Southern Baptist Convention leadership, the executive committee, rejected a lot of reforms that activists and victims had said would have helped prevent sexual abuse. And so what we found, you know, as you mentioned at the start of the show, 380 church leaders and volunteers who had been alleged to have who faced sexual misconduct allegations. And that includes, you know, those who were convicted, charged, credibly accused, and successfully sued or confessed or resigned. But as you said, you know, it's not confined to any one type of church. We found it. We found these cases range, you know, from mega churches in Houston to tiny, tiny little congregations located in rural areas.
Lisa, some of the stories that are included in this investigation are very troubling to hear and read about. Could you tell us about Anne Marie Miller's story and how it fits in with the larger patterns you found in this investigation?
That's really a case that Rob knows more about. I'll let him talk about that one.
Sure, Rob.
Sure. So Anne Miller she was a teenager when she was a youth pastor at her church, or a youth pastor that she knew, started a relationship with her, allegedly, that turned sexual. That man, the case against him is pending right now. But Miller, after learning that he had gone on to work at the Southern Baptist Convention's mission board and was a somewhat high-ranking official there, she met with the mission board in 2007, and they had a very, very an internal investigation that mission board officials said at the time supported her story. And after that investigation concluded, her alleged attacker was able to leave, go work at churches in Arkansas before finding work at the South Carolina Baptist State Convention. And I think her story was kind of a watermark when it kind of broke in July for a lot of Southern Baptists. You know, they've been grappling with a few high-profile scandals involving sexual abuse and the handling of sexual abuse in the months before that. And so the reaction that, or I guess the response from mission board officials that came to light when Miller came forward, I think definitely was kind of a wake-up call to a lot of people about how these things have been handled internally often, and some of the language that's deployed when talking to victims. I think the quote that stands out is from a mission board official who, just after the investigation had concluded, they were trying to ask her to forgive the attacker and, you know, move on with her life.
We read these reports of some of these women having abortions as a result of the sexual abuse. Were the perpetrators of these crimes, Lisa, were they pressuring these women to terminate their pregnancies?
There are a couple of cases where the perpetrators pressured the young women, often they were teenagers, to terminate pregnancies to hide what happened. One of the people who came forward early on and asked the leadership in the SBC to make changes was Debbie Vasquez, and so we focused on her in the first story. And I guess I wanted to add something to what Rob said earlier about the central, decentralized nature of the church. Even though that is entirely true, that there's this concept of local autonomy, these churches also elect leadership. They elect an executive committee every year, and often these are pastors who serve 2 years or in the positions of president, vice president, and they really do set some general guidelines and policies for and the direction for the entire church. So one of the things we did look at was how some of them had handled individual decisions, as well as failing to, at their own churches, as well as failing to act on some of the reforms victims like Debbie Vasquez wanted. So they're, even though they are decentralized, they sort of have, they do have these leaders that stand up and try to set some direction. And they also do sometimes expel churches from their group. And one of the things that we found was that they had not done so for churches that continued to employ people who they knew were abusers or who hired someone who had been expelled from another church for being a sexual abuser.
We hear some of these really disturbing stories from the survivors of the abuse, but you also sat down and interviewed some of the predators who are now behind bars. What did they have to say for what they had done?
I did the interviews with our videographer, John Shapley, and he and I wrote to 20 different people who were in Texas prisons because we had in Texas more perpetrators like this than in any other state, in part because the SBC is such an important church in Texas. And three of them agreed to sit down and talk to us. There were others who wrote to us. The three of them had really different attitudes. One of them was from a very small church in a very small town. And Hezekiah Stallworth was very, I would say, repentant for what he had done. He considered what he had done to be sort of a mental illness. And he really spoke very eloquently about how he felt the Baptist church in particular was not honest enough about problems within the church, whether it be pastors or parishioners who deal with sex addiction or pornography addiction or other kinds of problems. And that the fact that the churches do not discuss it allows it to go undetected longer. There was another pastor I interviewed, a youth pastor who I think, Gary Welch, who was very much expressing repentance for what he had done. However, at the same time, you know, he seemed a little bit, you know, he was conflicted, I think, about it. He though said clearly, you know, youth pastors in particular have opportunities to get too close to teenagers, and there's a slippery slope between being a counselor and a pastor and being too close of a confidant. The third person, a guy named Steve Livingston, who was a deacon at a church in Corpus Christi, expressed really no remorse at all. In fact, he considered himself a victim. He abused several little girls who were in a church program, and he was driving them to movies, and they were sitting on his lap, kind of considering him sort of a grandfatherly figure, and he abused them. And the video we have in our series, which has these interviews, is very troubling. But I think it also, the reason we did it is we wanted to really provide real insight from these people who profess to be religious people, who certainly have had a lot of time to think about what they did.
That's Lisa Olson, Deputy Investigations Editor at the Houston Chronicle, and we had Robert Downen, reporter with the Houston Chronicle. The first of their three-part series was published over the weekend. You can read the investigation at HoustonChronicle.com and on MySanAntonio.com. Lisa and Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
And that's Arun Roth with The Takeaway. Alma, the little girl at the heart of the new children's book, Alma and How She Got Her Name, has a very long one.
Her name is Alma Sofia Esperanza Jose Pura Candela.
too long, according to Alma. So in the book, we see her father tell her the story of her name and how each of those who came before her are part of who she is. The book, written and illustrated by local author Juana Martinez-Neal, just won the Caldecott Medal, a prestigious prize in children's literature, and she came into our studios recently to talk to me more about it. Martinez-Neal is an immigrant to Arizona from Peru, and she told me the process of writing this book took a long time, and it took her coming to terms with her immigrant identity.
Was it easy? No. It took a long time to get it done. About, I would say, I worked on it on and off throughout 8 years.
Wow.
I know. And mainly because of I kept getting stuck. And yeah. I didn't know what to do next.
What were you stuck on?
To begin with, the first thing, the character. Hmm. I had four different Almas before the one that I used in the book.
In terms of the illustration.
Finding how Alma looked, what she looked like. I did some that were more realistic looking. And because it was autobiographical, maybe that's what kept me getting stuck, because I was trying to draw myself. And then some were too realistic. And I will have one Alma and I go, this is perfect. I love her. This is my Alma. And then, well, you know, some months will go by. I looked again and I go like, no, it's not. And that happened over and over and over until I found the Alma that is in the book.
What was it about her when you knew it was right?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think in some way I was no longer drawing myself. I was drawing my daughter. Hmm. But mixed with other people, too, that I love. So I think it was that space that I, you know, gave the character. Mm-hmm. So it was I was able to, like, take myself out of the picture and now just focus on her. I think that's what worked. But one thing that I think the moment that I knew I had Alma is I had this little drawing of this little girl, and I was working on another book. I don't remember which one, but I was working on another book, and I was like, okay, I'm going to draw something really quick. So I drew this little girl, and I drew my grandma next to her. Hmm. And how I felt she was, not how she really looks like, but how I felt the memory of my grandma.
Yeah.
And when that happened, when seeing the two together, everything made sense. Everything just, something clicked. And then I remember being, I still have that piece of paper. Hmm. And I start playing with names. And I have Alma, Sofia, Esperanza. And I wrote a list of names that I possibly would like to have use. But that's, I think that was the starting point of the real Alma story as it is now.
So at the end of the book, you have a little note from you, right? Mm-hmm. And about your full name. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Well, my name when I was born was Juana Carlota Martinez Pizarro. Juana is my dad's mother, Juana Francisca. Mm-hmm. And then Carlota wasn't supposed to be Carlota, was supposed to be Carla. My mom had an uncle that she really loved but passed. And in a way to honor him, she gave me that, what she thought was going to be my middle name, Carla. But what happened was that my father didn't think it was strong of a name for me, too strong of a name, and I needed something different. So he just changed my name when he was writing it on the birth certificate. And just like that, my name changed. And then you carry both last names, Martinez right. from my dad and Pizarro from my mom's side of the family.
Yeah. So why did you choose to put that at the end of the book, to tell your own story there?
Because that was what got the book started.
Yeah.
My idea, they said, you know, it sounds cliche, but just tell what you know, mm-hmm. you know, the story of how my name changed. And even my name itself has been something that has been so constant throughout my life that story I knew, mm-hmm. that story I could tell, yet I had to take myself out and tell the story of Alma, even though I used still my relatives, to be able to make the book.
Let's talk a little bit about your own story, right? So you are from Lima, Peru. You emigrated here when you were 24. How did that process and the process of trying to learn how to live in a new country and in America kind of change the way that you saw yourself and your writing?
I don't know if everyone will go through this, but in my experience, it was I moved and I came as an adult and with my own, you know, culture and my own way of doing things. And then I come and I'm put into this new country with a different different language, and where everything is absolutely different from, like, saying hello. You just kiss everybody in Peru, even though you don't know them. You just, that's how you greet. You give a kiss. And if there's a room with 100 people, there's 100 kisses right there. I'm not kidding.
Very different than here, right? Okay.
Yeah, and here you have, you know, like, your bubble.
Yes, yes.
And so there's like a cultural shock, really.
Yeah.
But I think in order to adapt, I had to quiet my own culture, who I was. I couldn't paint anymore because I didn't have anything. You know, I didn't have my supplies. I remember bringing them, but it was just in a corner on a box, you know, in a box just there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wasn't writing because I was adapting to this new language.
How did you come out of that? How did you get back into writing and
funny
drawing?
Enough, my husband kept saying, you need to go back to children's illustration. You need to go back to children's illustration. And I didn't even know I could make picture books. That's how clueless I was.
Mm.
But then I remember going online and I was, well, maybe I have to listen to him. So I go on Google and I found SCVWI, Society of Children's Books Writers and Illustrators.
Mm.
So I go on the website and I go, oh my God, there's a whole group of people that all they do is picture books. And like, so I joined like immediately. But that kind of got me back to painting, back to children's illustration. And writing took a little longer, but it was a trip back to Peru in 2009 that made me realize that what I really needed to do was paint my culture, who I am, what I knew. And that's when, in 2009, I think that's when everything starts making more sense.
So now you've come very far, right? You were just honored with the Caldecott, and you won this award at the same time as two other Latina authors, right? Meg Medina, who won the Newbery this year, Elizabeth Acevedo won the Prince Prize. I want to talk to you a little bit about what this award means to you and also what you think this says about the future of writers, the future of this generation of writers.
What does it mean? So much. As a Latina, as a woman born in Peru, born and raised in Peru, it's unbelievable. Besides the fact that I grew up with no picture books. I mean, that's just something, you know, it's just crazy to think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great moment for all voices to be heard. And we're here. I mean, I think we are here because of everyone that came before us. I mean, we're not, it just didn't happen from one day to the other. This is the work of scholars and illustrators and authors and editors that want to push these stories that have not been heard as often.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to hear from other, we need to hear all voices, not only the what used to be the norm, which was stories of white children,
mm-hmm.
because we're all American. I mean, that's my hope, that we don't see this as a Latina story, a picture book about a Latina girl. I want it to be a story, just an American story, one more American story. And that's my hope.
Juana Martinez Neal, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Good Monday morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. With Lauren Gilger in Phoenix, I'm Mark Brody. Coming up this hour, why some big game hunters are heading south of the border. And we'll check in with the BBC on some of the top international stories coming up this week.
But first, Denver teachers are walking out of the classroom today. It's the latest in a string of teacher strikes that have taken place around the country in the last few years. The major issue at hand in Denver, as it was in Arizona, is teacher pay. Joining us with the latest on this strike is Madeline Will. She's a reporter with Education Week out of Washington, D.C. Good morning, Madeline.
Good morning.
So can you begin by telling us how extensive it looks like this strike is? How many teachers are walking out today?
So there are over 5,000 teachers in Denver, and we don't have the final counts on how many teachers have actually walked out, but definitely within the thousands. There's 90,000 students in Denver, so schools are remaining open. So it's kind of a big strike right now.
Yeah. So schools remaining open, how are they doing this?
The district has hired hundreds of new substitute teachers and also asked some administrators to fill in the gaps.
So it seems like they knew this was coming. Let's talk about the negotiations and what the strike is about here. So the main issue, right, is the pay system for teachers. Describe for us how that works.
Yeah, so right now Denver has kind of a complicated performance pay system. So teachers get financial bonuses for if their students are doing well academically or if they work in a high-poverty school. And the union is saying, let's cut down on these bonuses and just give teachers higher base salaries across the board. And the district says we need to keep financial incentives for teachers who work in the city's poorest schools.
And you said this sort of illustrates the national swing in policy priorities, right? Like this is a debate that is going on around the country.
Yes. The question of whether teachers should get performance bonuses for what if their students do well or on where they work versus just giving paying teachers all teachers more.
Okay. So there were negotiations over the weekend. No success there, obviously. What is it that the two parties can't agree on here?
There's a couple things. So the district has said it doesn't have enough money to give teachers everything they're asking for. And the union is saying we still need higher base salaries. Our teachers can't afford to live where they work. Let's put more money into the salary schedule.
Okay. Like I said in the intro here, this is not the first teacher strike or walkout we've seen happen even in recent months here. L.A. just happened. It looks like Oakland could face another teacher strike. So at Education Weekend, as you're looking at this from a national point of view, why is it that you think this is going on?
Well, teachers kind of are fed up. We saw what happened last year with Arizona and West Virginia, and I think that inspired teachers across the country to kind of fight for higher pay raises and better learning conditions for their students.
And what kind of impact might this have at this point? We don't know how many teachers are walking out and the schools are remaining open, but based on the way other strikes and walkouts have happened around the country, does this seem like it could go on for a while and the schools might have trouble staying open at some point?
Yes. We're not sure how long, you know, they're returning to the bargaining table tomorrow. But in Los Angeles, school stayed open as well. And a lot of students just didn't go to school, but principals were frustrated with the amount of work asked to do. So it's kind of a hectic situation. So we might see some problems in Denver as well.
All right. That is Madeline Will, a reporter with Education Week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Here's our co-host, Steve Goldstein, with the paper's editorial director, Phil Boas.
68,000 people gathered at State Farm Stadium in Glendale last night, but it wasn't for a concert or a football game. Instead, they were there to listen to Russell M. Nelson, president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church. The 94-year-old Nelson became LDS president a little over a year ago. Now, Phil Boas, how much has the LDS Church attempted to change recently, and how much of that was part of Nelson's message?
Well, I think one of the big changes that Russell M. Nelson, who is the president and prophet of the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is changing the name away from the Mormons to emphasis on the Church of Jesus Christ. And the reason for that is obvious. The Mormons of the LDS want to make it clear that at the center of their church is Christ. That's the Mormonism I grew up with. I grew up in the LDS Church and have always known. But it's doubted in the outside world. It's doubted by a lot of the Christian right, actually, who are quite critical of the Mormons, who don't believe they're real Christians. It's interesting. There were 68,000 people at the at State Farm Stadium the other night. And I was imagining Michael Bidwell looking at that and thinking, did the Mormons like football? And I can assure him they do. They love football as much as the Catholics do. But it was only 20 years ago that there was an ecumenical event at Bank One, then Bank One Ballpark, now Chase Field, where, you know, various religions came together. They dropped their differences and meet in this stadium. And the word got out that the evangelicals were not interested in sitting side by side with the Mormons. And so the Mormons sort of just quietly removed themselves from the event. And quite a difference from what we saw the other night, because you had a lot of the leadership, you know, the governor, you had Martha McSally, you had Michael Crow, a lot of the top leaders in the state were there to greet, you know, the president of the church, who's a significant leader in this country.
Many groups, not all, are trying to have a big tent, and they're trying to make sure that people don't think of them as being caught in the past and really be progressive. Has he tried some of that? Because this is a notoriously conservative church, at least their approach.
Yes. Well, so his big message, and we invited him to write an op-ed for The Republic, is that faith is still relevant in today's ever more secular world, that people still need faith. And he gets at it as somebody who is really a renowned heart surgeon during his professional days. He talked about how he could, you know, repair hearts with suture and scalpel and things like that, but he couldn't repair hearts that were broken and hearts that were suffering because families had fallen apart and things like that. And that's where spirituality comes in. And he was speaking to people of all faiths, you know, that, you know, there is a place for God and we need God in our lives.
Do you, as someone who grew up in the church, and I know that you have other participation now to some extent, but is there a feeling that the church needed to update itself, to be more welcoming? I'm not saying the Mormon church is unique in this, but you have a number of people who've left the church who are concerned about certain things, partly the hierarchy.
Well, let me frame this so people can understand where I come from. My mom joined the church when I was 5 years old. When you turn 8 in the Mormon church, when you can discern between good and bad, then you have the opportunity to be baptized within the church. I was baptized at 8. I had 4 sisters. They were all baptized. I went on a Mormon mission. I went to Brigham Young University. And I married a devout Catholic, and we tried to do 2 churches, and it was too confusing. It was too difficult. And eventually, I ended up going most of my adult life to Mass rather than sacrament meeting, which is the Mormon main meeting. So, and my dad never joined the church, and my dad was a really bright guy who was always supportive of the church. He was a doctor here in Phoenix. And I kind of learned from him how to be supportive, you know, as a father of my family's Catholic church. But I still feel culturally Mormon. I still have enormous love and respect for the Mormon people. And, the Mormon church, one of its great attributes is that it does know how to move with the times. It does modernize. The Mormons point to scripture that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, but they have a church that has moved with the times and continues to do so. And Nelson is evidence of that.
Absolutely. I just have to ask it, 94-year-old man, how is it possible that he can be a visionary leader into the future?
He's a 94-year-old man. The one aspect of this guy that I think most Mormons have enjoyed the most is that he still skis the powder on these huge mountains in Utah. And this is a very spry 94-year-old. And he has, you know, one of the changes that has come about is they've shortened the meeting schedule so that Mormons could get home and spend more time with their family, you know, be with family. And because that is at the center of the Mormon church, you know, the family unit is key. And they're about building and developing healthy, strong families.
Phil Boas, thanks.
Thank you.
An international summit on Wednesday will look at the regional influence Iran now has in the Middle East. That's one of the top stories in the coming days on the international stage. With me for a weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, let's start in Venezuela, where tomorrow another day of protest is scheduled as a political standoff continues. What's the latest from that country?
Well, that's right, Mark. So the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, has called yet another national protest against the government of President Nicolas Maduro tomorrow. Now, remember, last month, Maduro was sworn in for a second term in office following disputed elections last year, which many opposition leaders did not contest because they were in jail or simply boycotted them. So the opposition says those elections were rigged, a charge Maduro denies. Now, Mr. Guaido has declared himself interim president. He has the backing of numerous countries, including the US, but some other countries like Russia, Bolivia, for instance, in Latin America, continue to support the socialist President Maduro. Now, one element we're watching in all of this is which way the Venezuelan military goes. It holds the key. Right now, it's behind Maduro, but there are some in the military who have publicly switched sides. And by the way, many Venezuelan watchers will tell you the military has a lot to lose financially if it gives up on Maduro. Various clandestine deals make life profitable for some top brass. So the question is, will the military turn on him? That's one to watch.
And Rob, while the politics go on, some more immediate needs for residents of Venezuela, shortages of food and medicine continue. Does it seem as though there's any relief in sight for Venezuelans?
Well, it's difficult to see any. Millions of people have fled Venezuela, as you know. The country's suffering hyperinflation, other economic troubles. That renders food and medicine scarce. And since this crisis hit, Washington has announced sanctions on the oil industry, which, of course, is Venezuela's main earner. So little sign of things getting better. We've been hearing from some ordinary Venezuelans. Remember, that country's population of some 30 million. We've been asking them about their everyday lives.
It's an odyssey. You know what an odyssey is, right? It's an odyssey, everything. We don't have transport. We don't have food. We don't have electricity. We don't have gas. My house has been without gas for 2 months.
So, Mark, there has been an attempt, I should say, by Mr. Guaido to bring humanitarian aid into the country. But last week, the Maduro government blocked the main highway that would have let those goods in from neighboring Colombia. Why? Because Mr. Maduro calls this aid a Trojan horse. He maintains America is intent on illegally overthrowing his government and exploiting Venezuela's huge oil reserves.
All right, so that protest scheduled for tomorrow. The following day, Rob, on Wednesday, the U.S. will host an international summit looking at the regional influence Iran has in the Middle East, right?
Yes. Now, this conference is happening in Poland, of all places. It'll bring together countries from across the world. We're expecting Vice President Mike Pence to be there, for instance. Its focus, as you say, is on Iran's influence in the Middle East. It's being seen as part of President Trump's pressure campaign on Iran, which, of course, he sees as a malevolent actor in that region and beyond. Now, the conference itself has angered Iran. It summoned Poland's top diplomat in Tehran to complain and called off a Polish film festival there, too. In a tweet, Iran's foreign minister denounced the meeting as America's anti-Iran circus. So it's just the latest show of hostility between the U.S. and Iran this conference. I should just remind you, in recent times, Mr. Trump, of course, has withdrawn the U.S. from the international Iran deal. He restored U.S. sanctions on Iran, which Washington had lifted as part of that deal. Now, our reporter Martin Patience is today in neighboring Iraq. He says in the past 40 years since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the anniversary of which is this week, Iran has never been as influential as it is now, and that makes the U.S. and its allies very nervous. He says, ironically, the U.S. itself helped Iran.
The U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 removed Iran's biggest adversary, Saddam Hussein. And Tehran's influence now stretches from here to Syria, all the way to the shores of the Mediterranean. When America talks about Iran's military reach in these countries, it's referring to Shia militias.
Martin Patience in Baghdad there, Mark. And by the way, if you're looking for evidence of Iran's influence in the region, look no further than Thursday of this week, a trilateral meeting in the Russian Black Sea resort of Sochi. That will bring together Russia, Turkey and Iran to discuss the situation in Syria. There, Iran has considerable influence too. It's right behind President Assad, of course, who with continued Russian backing remains firmly in control in Damascus.
All right, Rob, finally this morning, the BBC will be covering this week a major science conference taking place later this week in Washington, right?
Yes, it's the American Association for the Advancement of Science, quite a mouthful. it's holding its annual meeting in Washington, D.C. This is a huge conference. It has more than 90 sessions per day. It has more than 1,000 delegates from all over the world, and therefore lots of international stories. Now, one of those that caught my eye is about ocean plastic. We've heard plenty recently about how damaging this is to the food chain, and that's led to attempts all over the world to restrict single-use plastics. But the session at this conference is about an unexpected secondary impact of all the plastic we toss into the ocean. It's a study of plastic debris from a tsunami that struck Japan and how that plastic material washed up on the shores of North America with organisms on board. So this is not just about plastic, it's about how invasive species can use that plastic to travel the world. So whereas organic debris like wood can break down and sink, scientists have found that plastic, even very small amounts of plastic, cannot. And these bits of plastic can support life as they float across the ocean. So we'll be watching the details of that session and many others at the AAAS meeting this week in Washington, D.C.
All right. Lots of, as always, to keep our eyes on. That's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And now let's dig deeper into Iran's influence. For that, we're joined by Arun Roth with The Takeaway. 40 years ago today, more than 2,000 years of monarchy in Iran came crashing down.
Greetings to you, Khomeini, they chanted, surging toward him, desperate to touch the hand or robe of the holy man, or to have something, anything, touched and blessed by him. To touch him, one man said, is to touch the person who speaks to God.
Reporting from Richard Roth in 1979, from the History Channel's Crisis in Iran. With the overthrow of the Shah, Iran became an Islamic republic, headed by the Ayatollah Khomeini. It was a shift that resulted in profound changes for Iranian society. To help us assess how the revolution changed Iran and impacted the United States' relationship with the country, I'm joined now by Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Behrouz, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, if you could set the stage for the revolution, and I think perhaps you might need to go back to the 1954 coup to help us understand, right?
Of course, I mean, that's one of the important points in the history of Iranian revolution. And that, you know, as a child growing up in Iran, that was one of the sort of narratives of where we were in the world, in the history, that this Iran was a nation that had a democratic government. And because people wanted to claim their own resources, particularly the oil, which was the main source of income for Iranians. And Prime Minister Mossadegh nationalized the oil industry. And of course, with the collaboration of the British intelligence and the CIA, by the way, that was the very first CIA covert operation that was executed in Iran in 1953. That overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh and reinstated the Shah. And then a whole period of decades of what is known in Iranian history as the decades of dark tyranny, with the support of the U.S., with the support of the CIA, and in different kinds of layers of sort of understanding of Iranians' history, people understood that there's a very intimate and close, direct connection with the rule of the Shah and the support of the U.S. So that's why, from the very beginning, the revolution against the Shah was, in a sense, a revolution against American influence in Iran.
But it seems like it took a lot of people here by surprise, or at least that the U.S. was not prepared for the revolution.
It wasn't only the U.S. which was not prepared for the revolution. No one was prepared for the revolution. In a sense, revolution had a very, very fast process of unfolding in Iran. And when President Carter visited Iran on the New Year's Eve of 1977, he saluted the Shah as creating the island of stability in the region. And it was only 6 months later that the demonstrations engulfed the entire country. And even when President Carter spoke those words, it wasn't a surprise to anyone, either the Iranian people, the Shah himself, and the leaders of the opposition. But things really unfolded fast and caught everyone by surprise. And of course, the U.S. relied primarily on their sources that were close to the regime of the Shah itself in order to understand the situation in Iran. That's why the U.S. intelligence was very much behind the curb when the revolution was happening in Iran.
So fast forwarding 40 years, to today. Right now, Iran is going through serious economic strife at a time when top U.S. officials are making clear calls for another coup or regime change, as we say in this century. This is National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking last year to the dissident group Mujahideen Khalq, or the MEK.
The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself.
What do you make of those remarks and what they might tell us about the future of U.S.-Iran relations under the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, those are the typical kind of statements that about the American policy. Sometimes these statements are broadcasted, declared very explicitly, sometimes not so explicitly. But it's been part of the American policy more or less in the last 40 years. I mean, we have ups and downs, and it really sustains that kind of skepticism that the Iranian government and Iranian people, to a certain degree, have about Americans' intentions. And I think one of the most important parts of this revolution, the 40th anniversary of which we celebrate today, was the right of self-determination. And it's very, very dear and important to Iranians of all walks of life, that idea of the right of self-determination. And these kind of threats, these kind of declarations, of course, does not help. And the only thing it does is to sort of embolden and empower more kind of radical militant factions inside Iran. So when Bolton and other American officials make these kind of statements, the only outcome of those statements are the sort of giving more currency and more legitimacy to that kind of political radicalism inside Iran.
Behrouz Ghamari-Tabrizi is a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Arun Roth at The Takeaway.
As climate change threatens species around the globe, there is a different kind of zoo in San Diego that's aiming to bring some endangered species back. The San Diego Zoo's Frozen Zoo is the largest animal cryobank of its kind. There, the cells of over 1,100 species are preserved. But according to the man who runs it, there are over 20,000 endangered species right now. So there's still a long way to go. Oliver Ryder is the director of conservation genetics for the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, and he says his eventual goal here is to create a global wildlife biobank, a network of labs around the world like the one in San Diego, to preserve the cells of more endangered species. Ryder has been there since the Institute was founded in 1975, and I asked him how revolutionary was this when it began.
The Frozen Zoo was a remarkable concept that built upon a relatively recent discoveries. Approximately 60 years ago was the first time living cells from an animal could be grown outside of the animal, that is, grown in the laboratory, mm-hmm. and frozen, and then thawed and resuscitated so that they could continue dividing and working. So when the Frozen Zoo started in 1975, it had the opportunity to begin collecting cells of animals that had never been preserved before, never had been grown before. Hmm. So it's built upon existing technologies, but is evolving into perhaps a revolutionary tool for characterizing biological diversity and contributing to its conservation.
Yeah. So you'll gather these samples, and you said people will send you these samples from animals all over the world?
Yes.
So how do you decide which are priorities and which animals, I guess, to try to preserve first?
Well, one of the priorities is their endangerment.
Yeah.
And the second consideration is, you know, can we grow the cells? We're very good at growing cells of mammals and birds. We're working very hard to grow cells of amphibians, but they're not as easy to grow. Hmm. Another consideration would be, do we have the technologies to use these samples for genetic rescue? We want to show the potential of banking these viable cell cultures to contribute to conservation efforts for those species that we're banking. Mm-hmm. So there we have policies in place, and we give this very careful consideration because we can't save everything.
Yeah, yeah. So give us an example or two of some of the animals that you have been able to save and how that process works.
Well, San Diego Zoo collaborated with other organizations and institutions to indeed save species by breeding them and reintroducing them back into the wild, like the California condor or the Przewalski's horse or the Arabian orcs. Mm-hmm. But none of those species have involved the use of cellular technologies. But now we're in a situation where there are species for which the gene pool, the largest extent of the gene pool, actually exists in the liquid nitrogen freezers of the frozen zoo. So, for example, the northern white rhinoceros, there's only two individuals left. The last male died last year. And so the species is more or less doomed in nature. But we have cell cultures from a dozen individuals that we are exploring the potential for using these to actually genetically rescue this unique form of rhinoceros.
And you use stem cell technology to do this, right?
That's what we're going to have to do in order to preserve the total genetic diversity that we can, because the genetic diversity, the size of the gene pool of northern white rhinos, is going to depend on using cells in the frozen zoo to bring that back into living animals. And we see that a opportunity to do this exists by converting the cells that we banked over the last 40 years from northern white rhinos into what we call induced pluripotent stem cells, cells that can make any cell in the body, mm-hmm. including reproductive cells, eggs and sperm. And this sounds pretty ambitious, which it is, and it sounds pretty astounding, which I think it is in some ways, but we know that it's possible to do this in some species because it's been done in the mouse.
Yeah. Have you heard the criticism that you're sort of playing God here, that you were interfering in something that was a natural process to begin with?
Well, thank you for raising that question, but I don't think that we see the extinction of the northern white rhinoceros as a natural process at all. It was due by intense efforts of humans to exterminate them for their horns. And as far as the role of humans' intervention, humans have been changing wildlife for thousands and thousands of years. We've caused the extinction of many species. We've changed their migration patterns. We've altered their habitat. We've introduced diseases and predators and have had a massive impact on the wildlife of our planet. Mm-hmm. So using these advanced genetic and cellular technologies to prevent the extinction of a species is an opportunity to intervene in a different way, to reduce the loss of species in ways that will be the only way to save some species.
So when you talk about saving species and preserving this sort of biodiversity of the planet, can you drive that home for folks who might wonder, you know, why does this matter? Why do we need this?
Well, this generation has an opportunity to make impacts that will be long-lasting in terms of what our descendant generations have in the way of wildlife and diversity of plants and animals. And it's part of the fabric of our world. And now we have an opportunity or perhaps a responsibility to try to pass it on to future generations.
That was Oliver Ryder, Director of Conservation Genetics for the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, where he runs the largest animal cryobank of its kind.
Just south of the Arizona border, big game hunting is a big business. Every winter, thousands of foreign hunters, most from the U.S., flock to Sonora for its trophy deer, bighorn sheep, game birds, and other species. Some say hunting policies have also been a boon to conservation efforts.
From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, Murphy Woodhouse reports.
It's just after sunrise, and hunting guide Jim Skosma is trudging through the brush up a small rise on a rural Sonoran ranch. He stops and whispers just shy of the top.
We should wait until that sun gets a little higher where we're not soaked.
He's hoping to give his client a good vantage on the trophy mule deer he traveled hundreds of miles from Northern California for. From the top, it's rolling hills tangled with mesquite, ironwood, and palo verde to the horizon at Rancho Grande, which doubles as a hunting preserve and cattle ranch. After a half hour silently waiting for the right-sized buck to pass through the draw below, Skosma shares his frustration with client and fellow Californian, Brandon Barnwell.
Yeah, about 20 deer come in.
Yeah, we're happy about something.
Rancho Grande is still a major cattle operation, but also supports sizable herds of healthy mule deer. With high-protein feed and breeding programs, some of the mule deer are managed in ways akin to the cows they share the ranch with. Through binoculars, client and guide glassed a number of bucks that easily bested what Barnwell knew back home, but that wasn't good enough. Rolling back to the ranch house after a long morning, I asked what they're looking for.
We're not sure.
Well, no, when we see
either a real good management buck or a trophy buck. We're just shopping right now.
A successful hunt for Barnwell could cost up to $15,000. A desert bighorn sheep hunt can command several times that price, and sometimes as much as $100,000. State officials are estimating up to $30 million in economic impact this season. That's hotel stays, outfitter fees, food, permits, tips to guides, and other costs for organizing hunts. Hunting is also a lifeline for ranchers. Jesus Fimbres' family owns the 48,000-acre Rancho Grande.
Sometimes the money comes very good from the wildlife. Sometimes they come from the cow operation. So we better do both things.
Fimbres' ranch is what is known as an UMA, or a conservation management unit. Getting that status, which allows his family to run hunts on the property, requires developing a management plan for the sustainable use of wildlife. There are now more than 1,600 of them in Sonora, adding up to over 18 million acres. Marco Antonio Valenzuela Martinez is head of forestry and wildlife at the State Agriculture Department.
No había conciencia antes.
Prior to the establishment of UMAs, roughly two decades ago, there wasn't as much conservation consciousness, he says. Now those that register UMAs care more for the animals on their properties because they have a financial incentive to do so. In his nearly 30 years guiding hunts in Sonora with his company Aero 5 Outfitters, Skosma says he has seen that change in mindset.
Yeah, when we first came down, the mule deer was just about gone. They were just worried about how much they could make that year and not the future.
The desert bighorn sheep population has also increased. Raul Valdez is a professor at New Mexico State University's Conservation Ecology Department.
And if it were not for the private enterprise, there would be very few sheep in Mexico.
As he sees it, hunting is a more effective conservation tool than ecotourism because most tourists require substantial infrastructure and will only go to areas with major wildlife concentrations. Hunters, on the other hand,
they're willing to live in a tent in the most extreme conditions and pay thousands of dollars for the opportunity to do so.
Back at Rancho Grande, Barnwell's patience eventually paid off. I got him on the phone shortly after he killed a massive four-point buck.
We're up on the hill where we were in the morning, so you know kind of where we were. We waited at least 20 minutes for a clean shot.
With a few days of hunting still left, he said Sonora had already exceeded his expectations. He texted his friends back home telling them to start saving up for next year. Murphy Woodhouse, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
In early 1970s Tucson, Ramon Jaurique co-founded the Mexican-American Yaqui and Others organization known as MAYO. It worked with the Pascua Yaqui tribe to help get federal tribal recognition for a specific purpose. Jaurique's great-grandson, Henry Barajas, explained via Skype.
The Department of Transportation wanted to build the I-10 interstate through their land, and he helped organize the community to stand up and say, no, we will not be boxed in by concrete barriers. We will not let you take our land.
Barajas, a former journalist in Tucson, was gifted his great-grandfather's documents. He found himself with old Mayo bilingual newsletters containing photos, poetry, and stories of activism lost to history for 40 years. He decided to write a book about his great-grandfather, whom he'd always called El Tata Rambo. But when he saw Congressman John Lewis's graphic novel of life during the Civil Rights Movement, he decided to move away from just typed words on a white page.
The image that just has always stuck with me my entire life is the moment that Ramon met with Cesar Chavez when they were touring the nation. So I felt like that picture was something that was really going to legitimize what I was trying to say.
Barajas turned his family's history into a comic book series he calls La Voz de Mayo, Tata Rambo. It was a nickname his family gave Haurique as a play on his war veteran status. And what emerged from Barajas' project was a clearer picture of Tucson in the 70s.
I took scenes from the newsletters that they had published. They went to the Pioneer Hotel to protest the building of the freeway. And just thinking about how that would have went down and using his words as kind of description for my narrative felt like something that I can translate perfectly.
The first chapter of La Voz de Mayo is out now, with the second and third chapters to be released in March and July. Unlike Marvel superheroes fighting villains, Barajas wants this comic book series to be more about documenting Latino and Arizona history, which he feels has its own superpower.
I want this to be something that you could teach in a classroom. You know, this is something that I think everyone can read, whether it be on any political spectrum. You can pick this up and get a feeling of an American hero, an activist that helped people.
That was Henry Barajas speaking about his comic book he set in Tucson about his great-grandfather.
All right, Mark. So as you know, last night was the 61st Grammy Awards. It was aiming to redeem itself from some criticism the show has faced in the past. The music industry, like Hollywood, has been accused of not being inclusive of women and artists of color.
This year, Alicia Keys hosted instead of a comedian. And during the opening monologue, she was joined by Michelle Obama, Jada Pinkett Smith, Jennifer Lopez, and Lady Gaga in a visual statement of inclusiveness. And ditching the typical comedy skits, Keys filled time with energetic musical performances.
This finger, I still see the shadows in my room. Can't take back the love that I gave you. It's unforgettable.
There were some other powerhouse performances by Cardi B, Janelle Monáe, and Diana Ross, who sang in an enormous red tulle dress and finished by wishing herself a happy birthday some 44 days earlier.
The winners this year were diverse, not only in background and styles, but no one artist dominated multiple categories as what happened last year. Childish Gambino won Record of the Year with This Is America, and Album of the Year went to Kacey Musgraves for Golden Hour.
But it wouldn't be an award show without some cringeworthy moments. Jennifer Lopez's Motown tribute had a lot of people scratching their heads, and Drake's acceptance speech was cut off when he started to criticize the Grammys.
Look, if there's people who have regular jobs who are coming out in the rain, in the snow, spending their hard-earned money to buy tickets to come to your shows, you don't need this right here. I promise you. You already won. But next, a special Grammy performance by Diana Ross.
And despite axing some speeches, the show managed to find the time to give a lengthy tribute to Recording Academy President Neil Portnow, who's stepping down this summer. But Lauren, despite all that, critics mostly agreed the Grammys were better than expected.
All that I know is you caught me at the right time. Keep me in your glow.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.